It was not death, for I stood up, and all the dead lie down. It was not night, for all the bells put out their tongue for noon. It was not frost, for on my flesh I felt Sirocco's crawl, nor fire, for just my marble feet could keep a chance cool. And yet it tasted like them all. The figures I have seen set orderly for burial reminded me mine, as if my life were shaven and fitted to a frame and could not breathe without a key. And 'twas like midnight some, when everything that ticked has stopped and space stares all around, or grisly frost, first autumn morn, peel the beating ground, but most like chaos, stopless, cool, without a chance farm or even a report of land, just to despair. This poem was written, it is believed, in the flood year of 1862. I'm now going to turn to several other poems of Emily Dickinson, written somewhat later. They're most of them not to be found in the anthologies. Most of them, when I proceeded to read straight through her work, were new to me. And these were some that struck me particularly. Oh, sumptuous moment, slower go, that I may gloat on. 'Twill never be the same star now I abundant see, which was to famish then or now, the difference of day, ask him unto the gallows led with morning. The snow that never drifts, the transient, fragrant snow that comes a single time a year is softly dried now. So thorough in the tree, at night beneath the star, that it was February's foot, experience would swear, like winter, as a face we stern and former knew, repaired of all but loneliness by nature's element. Were every storm so spiced, the value could not be, we buy with contrast, pang as good as near as memory. Alone, and in a circumstance reluctant to be told, a spider on my reticence assiduously crawled, and so much more at home than I immediately grew, I felt myself a visitor and hurriedly withdrew. Revisiting my late abode with articles of claim, I found it quietly assumed as a gymnasium where tap asleep and title off, the inmates of the air perpetual presumption took as each were special heir. If any strike me on the street, I can return the blow. If any take my property, according to the law, the statute is my learned friend. But what redress can be for an offense nor here nor there, so not in equity? That larceny of time and mind, the marrow of the day, by spider, oh, forbid it, Lord, that I should press upon. Now here's the satiric. Sometimes Emily Dickens did that sort of thing. He preached upon breadth till it argued him narrow. The broad are too broad to define, and of truth, until it proclaimed him a liar, the truth never flaunted a sign. Simplicity fled from his counterfeit present, as gold the pyrites shun. What confusion would cover the innocent Jesus to meet so an able man? The butterfly's assumption gown, in chrysoprase parchments hung, this afternoon put on, how condescending to descend and be a buttercup, the friend in a New England. To pile like thunder to its close, then crumble grand away, while everything created hid, this would be poetry. Or love, the two coeval come, we both and neither prove, experience either and consume, for none see God live. The mountains stood in haze, the valley stopped below, and went or waited as they liked the river and the sky. At leisure with sun, his interest fire, a little from remark withdrawn, the twilight spoke the spire. So soft upon the scene, the act of evening fell, we felt how neighborly a thing was the instant. How new must feel when traveling, if new have any heart, alighting at the dwelling twill enter like a dart. What news think when pondering, if news have any thought, concerning the stupendousness perceived freight? What news will do when every man shall comprehend his one, and not in all the universe same tale remain? Without a smile, without a throw, a summer's soft assembly to their entrancing end, unknown for all the times we met, estranged, however intimate, what a dissemblance. Let me not mar that perfect dream by an auroral fame, but so adjust my daily night that it will come again. Not when we know the prowl cost, the garment of surprise, was all our timid mother at home in Paris. This is the last of the Emily Dickinson poems I've chosen, and it may be familiar. It's interesting to me because it has quite a different pace to it than most of her poems. There came a wind like a bugle. It quivered through the grass, and a green chill upon the heat so ominous did pass. We barred the windows and the doors as electric moccasin that very instant passed, strange mob of panting trees, and fences fled away, and rivers where the houses ran, those looked that lived that day. The bell within the steeple wild flying tidings told, how much can come and much can go, and yet the world. I'm sure any woman poet is bound to have been influenced by Emily Dickinson. I'm going to read a poem or two that perhaps reflects that influence. But I'm going to read first of my own work, a poem which clearly does not. It was written, I recall, at a time when I was carrying around the work of Allen Ginsberg. Now, Allen Ginsberg is a clearly in the line of Walt Whitman, and Emily Dickinson did say about Whitman, she didn't know much about him, but she knew she had heard he was great down. This poem was one that I was probably waiting to be written when I was walking in what we people who live in New York provincially call the village. And I passed a garden, it's still there. One can't ever be sure those gardens are going to still be there, but I saw it the other day. A garden where there used to be the Women's House of Detention, and this was in December, there were things in bloom, and that set me on a train of thought, and I wrote in long lines, which seemed to have been a reflection of Allen Ginsberg's manner. The poem is called Time. It may be we are in the last day. 700 years ago to the week, on the 11th of December, the Kingdom of Wales went under. Today, the sixth day of the 12th month of the 1982nd year, according to the current reckoning, there are roses the size of an obsolete threepenny bit, one fingernail pink, the other minute, extravagant crimson, flanked by masses of sweet alyssum and one time-exempt purple pansy. On the site of what was formerly the Women's House of Detention, at the triangular intersection of 10th Street with Greenwich and 6th Avenue, just back of the old Jefferson Market Courthouse, whose tower clock revived, goes on weeping. And I think again of October violets, of their hardy refusal to adhere to conventional expectations, so hardy that I've finally ceased to think of it as stark. This phenomenon, which, in fact, I devoted myself in October to looking. A tame revenant of the blue fire alarm of the original encounter with the evidence among the dropped leaves and superannuated grass of the season of hickory nuts, that neither time nor place could be counted on to remain self-sufficient, that you might find yourself slipping back toward the past at any moment, or watch it well up in artesian springs of enactment, with the prospect of being drowned in that aperture's abrupt blue, in that twinkling at any moment. It was November, or near then, I found violets massed at the foot of the foundations of the castle of Chepstow, at the edge of Wales, not any longer as once covert, fecklessly undermining that sense of fitness so fragile that at any moment of one's childhood, whatever sense of continuity has not ebbed or been marked for demolition may break like an eggshell and be overrun from within by the albumen of ruin. They're out of season, purple, not any longer hinting at things, but announcing it with a flourish, the entire gorgeous, intractable realm of the forgotten, the hieratic, the heraldic, the royal, sprung open at the gouty foot of that anachronism on the fringes of a kingdom that went under at or near the downward slope of the 13th century. I have seen the artesian spring of the past foam up foot of the castle of Chepstow on a day in November. I've seen a rose size of a perfectly manicured crimson fingernail alive in a winter that does not arrive, though we plunge again toward south. Now for a poem which I'm conscious owing something owing perhaps entirely to Emily Dickinson. I'd been reading her work just 2 years ago at East. I was in California, and in California that year at Easter, the grass, which was still green, had begun to flower. And as it flowered, the color of the hill changed. Grass. Undulant across the slopes, a gloss of purple day by day arrives to dim the green. As grasses, I never learned the name, numberless, prophetic, transient, put on a flowering so multiform, one scarcely noticed. The oats grow tall, their pendant helmetfuls of mica drift, examined stem by stem, disclose alloys so various, enamelings of a vermeil so craftless, I all but despair of ever reigning in a meadow. Even the plebeian dooryard plantains, every homely cone tip earns a halo, a seraphic hatband of guarantee that dying for the unstudied, multitudinously, truly, lowly, has no meaning, is nothing, if not flowering, swarming reassurance, one more resurrection. Thank you. still in my mind Easter season, I'm going to read a poem called Triptych, which, as you see, has to do with Lent and Easter. It's in three parts. I imagined it as being a verbal equivalent of the kind of altar painting one sometimes sees where there is a major central panel that is larger than the two on either side. So there are two short poems on either side of a somewhat longer poem. First is Palm Sunday. Neither the wild tulip, poignant and sanguinary, nor the dandelion, blousily unbuttoning, answers the gardener's imperative, if need be, to maim and hamper in the name of, or the taste for rendering adorable the torturous implement. Never mind what entrails, not yet trampled under by the feet of fireball. Sing, my tongue, the glorious battle, mulch the olive groves, the flowering of apple and almond, the boxwood corridor, the churchyard yew, the gallows tree. Good Friday. Think of the Serengeti lions looking up, their bloody faces no more culpable than the acacia's claw on the horizon of those yellow plains. Think with what concerted expertise the red-necked, down-ruffed vultures take their turn. How after them the feasting maggots hone the flayed wildebeest rib cage clean as a crucifix. A thrift tricked out in ribbon rags that looks like waste. And wonder what barbed whimper, what embryo of compunction first unsealed the long compact with a limb-from-limb outrage. Think how the hunting cheetah, from the lope that whips the petal garden of her hide into a sandstorm, falters, doubling back, nagged by a lookout for the fuzzed runt that can't keep up, that isn't going to make it. Edged by a niggling in the chromosomes for these garrulous, uneasy caravans, where eons notwithstanding, silence still hands down final ignorant. Think of Charles Darwin mulling over whether to take out his patent on the way the shape of things can alter, hearing the whir in his own household of the winnowing fan. No system, it appears, can put a stop to winnowing out another little girl for no good reason other than the docile accident of the unfit before she quite turned seven. Think of his reluctance to disparage the Wedgwood pious he'd married into, his more than inkling of the usages disinterested perception would be put to. Think how, among the hard nosed, pity is with stunning eloquence converted to hard cash. Think how Good Friday can, as a therapeutic outlet, serve to ventilate the sometimes stuffy Lebensraum of laissez-faire society. An ampoule of gold, a mithridatic ounce of horror, sops for the maudlin tendency of women toward extremes of stance, from virgin blank to harlot sanctimonious official mourner. Myrrh and smelling salt, baroque placebos, erotic tableau vivant, dedicated to the household martyr, underwriting with her own ex votos the evolving ordinance of murder. The spear point glitters in the gore. Wonder at Olderby, what innovator, after the hunting cat halfway sniffed out remorse in the design of things, unsatisfied perhaps with even a lion's entitlement, first forged the iron of a righteousness officially exempt from self-dismay. Think whatever rueful thumbprint first laid the rubric sacerdotal doorpost, this victim, knowing, died without a murmur. How some fragment of what shudders lapped into that crumpled karma dreamed that it was once tiger. Easter morning, a stone at dawn, cold water in the basin, these walls rough plastic image, after the hammering of so much insistence on the need for naming, after the travesties that pass this face's grace, the unction of sheer non-existence, upwelling in this hyacinthine freshet of the unnamed. The subject of stone is one that one finds recurring in the work of Emily Dickinson. I think of the poem, it's a familiar one, in which she talks about the valves of tension. I've known one from an ample nation. I've known her from an ample nation. Choose one, then close the valve for attention like stone. And another of her satiric poems about a face devoid of love or grace, a hateful, hard, successful. A face with which a stone would feel as thoroughly at ease as they were the old acquaintances first time. The subject of stone and people turning to stone, which is obviously something that concerned Emily Dickinson in many ways, is the subject that I've done some thinking about also in the last year or so, and I've been writing or trying to write some poems about the Medusa myth. I'm going to read one, which isn't really part of that sequence, but it does deal with Medusa. It has to do with George Eliot, who in fact mentioned Medusa in her work every now and then, which gave me courage to think about mentioning Medusa in connection with work. This is a poem called Medusa at Broadstairs, and it's about a time in George Eliot's life when she was not George Eliot. She was Marian Evans. She was a successful editor and translator living in London. She was a friend of Herbert Spencer, the philosopher. In fact, they saw a great deal of each other while went to the opera together, enjoyed each other's company. But the thing about Herbert Spencer, he never married. He really couldn't make his mind settle anybody. He was much too rational. And George Eliot, for all her formidable intellect, was a person capable of great devotion. And she tried very hard to remain detached. And unfortunately, however, these resolutions, when one is a woman, and perhaps true of men, don't always hold. And George Eliot and Marian Evans went to a little town called Broadstairs on the North Sea, not far from Dover, spent a couple of weeks vacation. And she wrote Herbert Spencer a note in which she said that she was having a fine time not thinking at all, and she thought she might turn into something like a jellyfish pretty soon. Maybe you'll say, I'm near enough to the Medusa already. She did. But it's a lovely place. Why don't you come down? He came down and visited, and something happened that one doesn't know exactly, but there is a letter that she handed him that one can read in the collected letters of George Eliot. And it is out of that circumstance that this poem comes, Medusa at Broadstairs. A seaside place so tranquil, her very mind might drift, grow indolent, become a tide pool. The articulate spine, its resolutions and attenuation, all acquired at such a price, sweetly let go. This couldn't last, of course, it never did. On Saturday the 10th, H.S. came down, to whom she cheerfully agreed and let the fact be widely known that she was not attached. No use. The unwanted love child of a note she evidently handed him survived. The stored up spikenard of ardor in its ungainly vessel, whole forests of it bending and shimmering, again few. Age 33, and still so quick to feel, so soon a rigid gazing. Night terror, the huge claustrophobia of childhood starting up again, the dried shriek, the claw about the windpipe. Medusa, whether singing jelly with no backbone, stare of fury petrified in wait. The obscure, cold pool where Hetty, unlikely early offspring of George Eliot, mindless, adorable, the smoldering dark girl who must her fatuous ardor ditch be done away with, will not be brave enough to drown herself, have it over. The motions of a little vessel without ballast, she'd write. The horrors of this cold and darkness and solitude out of all human reach, becoming greater every minute, the bitter waters spread. The Arthur Donnithorns, the Stephen Guests ride by, John Chapman, Herbert Spencer. If you become attached to someone else, she ignominiously writes, then I must die. There will be more. The sudden cold about the knees, the inundated threshold. Maggie Tulliver, awake, borne outward by recurring nightmare of childhood. The actual surge. The same dark girl grown tall and mindful, whose excesses must be done away with. Drought. George Eliot is not yet. Hetty Sorrell, not yet. Nor Maggie Tulliver, except if you become attached to someone else in aching embryo. Only long-faced, brainy Marion, prone to hysterics. Back in London, the usual servant, four walls closing in, headache that lasts an age, are sure to follow. Another poem about the life of a woman. This is Dorothy Wordsworth. She was a very gifted writer, much too shy about the public to think about getting anything published. But she did keep journals, which she gave to her brother William, and which he used in his poetry. They really were collaborators. I don't think she minded that at all. I mean, in fact, she kept a journal which she gave to him to read. The story about William and Dorothy Wordsworth is they were two people who had much in common. They were separated at the ages of 8 and 9, I believe, when their mother died, their father had died a few years before, and they were sent to different relatives and didn't see much of each other until they were in their teens. And when they were reunited, they found so much in common that I think one can say in a certain sense they fell in love. In any event, Dorothy soon resolved to keep house for her, especially after William went off to France, got involved with a French woman, and produced a legitimate child. She was the one who broke the news to the family. And so she became, I think, indispensable to him in many ways. They did settle eventually in the town of Grasmere. That is the famous place where they lived. They lived in some other houses, too. in a place that is now known as Dove Cottage. The day came, however, when William decided that he would get married to, it was a joint decision. I think that Dorothy had part of it, but he decided to marry Mary Hutchinson, who was Dorothy's old friend. And I saw when I read the journals of Dorothy Wordsworth that the week when these things, when these decisions were made, was a very traumatic one for both of them. And out of that and a visit I paid to Grasmere years ago comes this poem called Grasmere. Rainstorms that blacken like a headache where mosses thicken, and the morning smell of jonquil, the stillness of hung fells thronged with the primaveral noise of water. Contentment pours in spate from every slope. The lake fills, the kingcups ground, and still it rains. Sheep graze, their black lambs bounce and skitter in the wet. Such weather, one cannot say here why one is still so happy. Cannot say, except it's both so wild and so tea cozy, cozy, so snugly lovelish. I run into the ground complacent, nonetheless is given pause. At Dove Cottage, dark rooms gloom with coal fires. The back stairs escape hatch into a precipitous small orchard still opens. Bedded cowslips, primroses, fritillaries checkered upside down, down brown tulips still flourish where the great man fled the neighbors. A crank, ye torrents with your strong and constant voice, protest the wrong, he cried, i.e. against the Kendal to Windermere Railway. My middle age a Tory, a somewhat tedious egotist, even his wild oats sown abroad when young. He cannot, his sister had conceded, be so pleasing as my fondness makes. A coda to the epistolary cry, oh, Jane, the last time we were together, he won my affection. What gives one pause? Otherwise, one might not care, as one finds one does, for William Wordsworth is Dorothy. Wednesday, he read me his poem. After dinner, he made a pillow of my shoulder. I read to him and my beloved. The upstairs bedroom, where the roof leaks and the chimney smoke, the cool buttery where water runs still voluble under the flags, the room she settled into after his marriage to Mary Hutchinson and shared with as the family grew, first one, then two of the children. The newsprint, she papered it for warmth. The circle of domestic tranquility cannot guard her who sleeps single from Cumbrian cold, still legible. Such was the dreamed of place, so long too much to hope. It was in winter, at Christmas, when he was last at Thornsey. And every day, as soon as we rose from dinner, we used to pace the gravel in the garden till. And this, transcribed for Jane alone from one of William's letters, oh, my dear, dear sister, with what transport shall I again meet you, with what rapture? The orphan dream they'd entertained, that she had named the day of my felicity, to live together under the same roof in the same house here at Devco. A quiet night, the fire flutters, and the watch ticks. I hear nothing else save the breathing. Spring, when it arrived again, would bring birch bolt filmy as the bridal veil she'd never wear. Birds singing, the sacred stain of bluebells on the hillsides, fiddleheads uncoiling in the brake, inside each coil, spine of bronze, pristinely hoary. Male, clean-limbed ash trees whiskered with a foam of pollen, bride-like above white moss common, a lone wild cherry, candle mirrored in the pewter of the lake. On March 22nd, a rainy day, with William very poorly, resolves were made to settle matters with Annette in France and that he should go to marry. On the 26th, a black, followed by a morning fine. At breakfast, William wrote part of an ode. It was an intimation. The day after, they took the excitement to Coleridge at Keswick, arriving soaked to the skin. There, after dinner, she had one of her headaches. A bad one, gas worse, the packed ganglion's black blood clot. The day of my felicity curled up inside a single sack with its perfidious twin, the neurasthenic 19th century housemate counterpart of William, corrigibly nervous stomach. I do not know from what cause it is, he wrote, but during the last 3 years I have never had a pen in my hand 5 minutes before my whole frame becomes a bundle of an uneasiness. To ail, here in this veil, this hollow, formed as though to be the vessel of contentment, of sweet morning, smelling of jonquil, of tranquility at night, of habitual strolls along the lake shore, among the bracken, the old coiled up agitation glistening, birds singing, green birches in their wedding veil, the purple stain, a bluebell, attachment, not so rich, so dark, so dense a node, the ache still bleeds, still by. Thank you. I'm going to conclude with a shorter poem. Which is one of the sequence of poems having to do the Medusa story. It's called Hippocrene. Hippocrene, for those of you who are into Greek mythology will know, is the name given to the pool that was stamped by the foot of the winged horse Pegasus, who was born of the decapitated corpse of Medusa after Perseus went on this errand and to get her head, which, as you also know, turned everyone who looked at it to stone. But this has to do with the Hippocrene, which is associated with the idea of poetic inspiration. As I thought about that pool, I found it connected in my mind with a passage from Virginia Woolf's novel, The Wave, which I first read when I was a sophomore in college, and very unsure of my own identity, and that's perhaps why I've never forgotten this particular passage. It goes like this. I came to the puddle. I could not cross it. Identity failed me. We are nothing, said, and fell. The cold spring of an intense depression, moon horror-struck posthumous offspring of Medusa, harbinger of going under, of death by water. Though above the pillars of ruined Sunian, the air is calm, the white-lipped, violet-hued flower-bed drowning, spraying at the rim, lies sleek with signals of unbeing. The cold hoofprints doorway into nothing, metamorphosing from a puddle in a courtyard, the huge eruption of blank seas the psyche cannot cross, the terror-twinning muse, the siren and the soul, done and undone by water. Whether beyond the stormy Hebrides, the voyage out, the long look forward to excursion to the lighthouse, the ooze closing over, fin far out, the waves break.